we have already sat through together about a day and a half of our retreat. We have less than 1 day, 24 hours left. Already, I trust it is clear from your own experience what samsara, the mind of samsara, dis-ease or distress, the endless mental masturbations of the mind, what that is. You have perhaps painfully had to taste over and over what mind does. The endless vain circles that it goes in. I trust you have also gotten some sense of how, practically speaking, some techniques, body, mind, breath, so on, can help us to dislodge from some of our more basic illusions, delusions. Again, from your own experience. You know this, not because I have told you it is so or you have read somewhere that it is supposed to be so. Torturous and difficult practice is not necessary. However, for a stubborn soul, sometimes bitter medicine is necessary. For a very stubborn illness, sometimes a strong medicine is what is needed. However, this strictness, if you want, this maybe even seems harshness at times, sitting through the nights, hour after hour, is not something that we are imposing on you from outside as an authority. It is something that we, each one of us, take upon ourselves. Grateful, and we pursue that ourselves. We are the ones who, if any pushing needs to be done, we are the one that pushes ourselves. Even the kesaku, the stick of compassion, is only used when you ask for it. As your practice matures, it becomes clear there may be a time when strictness is necessary. For example, a simple discipline, daily meditation, for example. Well, I'm busy. We're all busy. The question is, are you going to make a commitment, for example, to sit in the morning, or to sit in the evening, or even to sit 2 days a week regularly? Is this absolutely necessary? No, but it is relatively necessary. It's very helpful. It's not the answer to everything. I think this is already clear to you, isn't it? rather strange but insightful story from the Lotus Sutra. Well, that guy got it all right, and he did it for a million zillion years on the Lotus Sutra, on the Lotus. You know, the lotus flower is supposed to be a symbol of awakening. And that's what he was sitting on, the lotus throne. Well, obviously, you can already, I think, see through that. And yet, practically speaking, in our day-to-day lives, some discipline can be very helpful. Otherwise, what happens? You find yourself running in the same old circles again. Already bored with it, already dissatisfied with it, already knowing it leads nowhere, and yet you don't know how to get out of that. So sometimes it helps to put a stop on that. One very simple way is, for example, a regular daily meditation, zazen, taking time out. You don't want to disrupt your family life, for example, create discord. Oh, where's Dad again? He's off getting enlightened somewhere. It should be done in a way that does not create discord in the rest of your life. So perhaps getting up early before the rest of your family is up, whatever, you can figure that out for yourself. And of course, when you can, sitting with a group or having a retreat like this, a precious opportunity, a precious chance. But it's not just something we do here for a couple of days. Maybe you reach some kind of high peak experience, and then it starts to dribble away, of course, after a couple of days. Shit, I want to go back to that. It's not that kind of thing. A retreat is very helpful, in a sense, to charge you up and to make it crystal clear. But the practice must be something that is constant. Constant. It doesn't mean you're always doing the formal zazen posture. Of course not. It means when you're focusing on something at work or at home that you can be totally focused with your own self out of the way on what needs to be done. Whether it's listening to the concern of a friend, a family member, or having to do something that you really don't like to do. This kind of thing is a precious, precious teacher in our practice. When things go well, it's very easy to fall into self-satisfaction, to dwell in our relative states that we have realized. When things don't go well, that's the real test. That's when we can learn to really be thankful. We don't want to create problems, of course, but if they are there, inevitably, to recognize them as our teacher at that time, and to humbly learn from that. Again, we're not looking for difficulties or troubles, but I assure you, you will encounter them. You will not leave this retreat and for the rest of your life never have a problem. If you do, you are very seriously deluded. So, it's important to understand the relative value of a practice and a discipline and a retreat like this. You're all here, I suppose you have some idea why. But also the importance of then carrying that out in your day-to-day life. Not at the same intensity. You're not going to go home and sit 15 hours a day, I don't think. You don't need to. But to have some base in the practice continue is very helpful. As important as all of that is, it still is, if we want to be technically accurate, that all is relatively important, relatively necessary. It is all the stuff that the Buddha of penetrating wisdom did perfectly, right? And of course the point of that story, I haven't completed it yet, I will today. Up until now, the point of the story has been that he did all of that perfectly, and yet he did not awaken. This is not to say that all of the practices he did, or all of the practices that you do, are useless. Not at all. Not at all. But with what mind are we doing that? Is there still some intention to get something out of it for myself? That practice is not yet whole, is not yet pure, is it? In the beginning, of course, we often have what we can call some selfish motive. I want to get enlightened. I want to get rid of all my problems. That's inevitable in the beginning. That's why most people begin. It's fine. But if the practice is done properly, before long, it becomes clear. It becomes obvious to you. Again, not because someone told you or you read about it. From your bones, your body tells you. This is something for all beings, not for me. As we recite in the four vows, beings are numberless vowing to set them free, or numberless beings set free. That is, in a sense, true awakening. Not my awakening or your awakening. An awakening which includes, must include, everything down to the last grain of dirt. If it doesn't, it's still something that you are attaining. So relatively speaking, these techniques, some of them I've talked about and demonstrated, they have their place, they have their value, but don't let them get in the way. Don't let them become a stumbling block. Rather, let them be a method that can help you to open up to the reality that you are, not to create something else. We're not here to create something else or to attain some blissful state of mind, although that may happen, may go in and out. It's not so important. In a very real sense, Zen is not a state of mind at all. However subtle or however profound, or however liberating. Buddhism, not just Zen, but Buddhism. The word itself comes from the term to awaken, Buddha. Supposedly when asked, Buddha said he was awake, Buddha, an awakened one, as we all are. Buddha. To awake to reality is not an experience. The self has experiences. Good ones, bad ones, all kinds of experiences. They are real enough for the self. They are all the self has. That is samsara. I think we already know that to some extent. Anything the self can experience, however high, however low, anything the self experiences is shot through with dukkha, with dis-ease. As soon as we start to enjoy the object of our desire, what happens? we start to lose interest in it, maybe even start to abuse it. Or we become possessive and don't want anyone else to touch it. Either way, it causes distress and dis-ease for ourselves and for others. When you really see for yourself dukkha, dis-ease, another more general term, samsara, is kind of like the whole universal aspect of dukkha, samsara, the endless rebirth, the endless continuation of that dis-ease. When you clearly see that, when you really clearly see that, you cannot come to rest in anything. The practice, in a sense, becomes very easy. It becomes inevitable at that point. You can't be fooled, or at least not for long, by the events, the experiences of the world, because you already have recognized. You haven't experienced everything. You can never experience everything. But you know the very nature of experience itself, however high or however low. It does not lead to the end of dis-ease. But you see what the self does. The self thinks, well, I haven't had every experience yet.
True.
So, a couple more. Maybe one in Italy, huh? Or one in Switzerland, and then it'll be better, huh? Or one with that woman, or that man, or that job, or that position, that recognition that I receive, whatever it is. You can see, I think, from your own experience, huh? The self, by its very nature, cannot come to rest in any experience, because experience itself is unstable, dependent upon condition. It comes and it goes, as does the self. Thus, we throw ourselves into practice, which is not clearly trying to have some kind of an experience. You can see that, right? No experience will do. Awakening is not an experience. It's waking up to reality. The reason it's called awakening is because upon awakening to what you really are, you realize the depth and the width, the universality of the delusion, of the dream, if we use the metaphor. From the point of self, everything is samsara. It is impossible for the self to get out of samsara. It cannot. So we can stop that vicious cycle of the will trying to pull itself up by its own bootstraps. Is it clear? We can stop trying to do that because it doesn't work. It's simply prolonging the delusion. Doesn't mean we stop doing anything, we don't do anything. No. In a sense, we work very hard. But what Buddhism calls right, correct, proper effort, directed towards allowing the illusion itself in its totality to come to an end. It cannot be maintained. It is an illusion. When you get to the end, it becomes obvious. It is, in that sense, ultimately, it is an illusion. The self and all its experiences, ultimately speaking, are not real. They have no lasting reality. The illusion cannot be maintained. It is unself-sustainable by its very nature. It cannot be sustained or maintained. And yet, the self is that very effort, trying somehow, grasping at this, grasping at that, running away from this. Something is maintained, but it is not what the self seeks. It is rather the continuation of the dis-ease. Thus, the way that we practice, not going out into the world, of course, trying to have more experiences, we know that doesn't work, but not going into an inner world of memories and dreams and reflections, inner experiences either. In a very profound sense, that's no closer to reality than the external, the self projecting itself out there or in here. Neither one is true, finally. And so, we practice the way that we practice. This has been a very simple, straightforward retreat. Small number of people, not a lot of paraphernalia. You did bring one small Buddha statue there, a little incense, a couple of sticks, that always comes in handy, especially in a school of peace. Huh? But it's clearly very low key, very minimalist, if you will, which I think is quite appropriate. And we are quietly practicing, in a sense, on our own, each one, our own little cushion here, and yet we're also practicing very well as a unit, working together. It's marvelous to see how we can just come together from, what, four different countries, four different nations. Some of us have never met, but just to work together as one, for this common purpose. That itself is a very, very precious part of the practice. Doing this together. If you'd like to stand up for a minute and stretch, please do. So without willful effort, let us make the best use of our precious remaining time here, almost 24 hours. Tonight, I believe around 9 p.m., we will end for the evening sitting. And then we ask all of you, especially because we don't want you to get in an accident or something going home, to have a good night's sleep tonight. Okay? Is that understood? The last two nights, we encouraged you to stay up, to sit. Tonight, we encourage you not to, rather to sleep, for good reason. So I believe it's around 9 o'clock. We will chant perhaps the four vows, and then that will be the end of this evening. Then, if you want to sit in your room, you can, but please, if you need sleep, especially to make sure you get home safely tomorrow, please get a good night's sleep. But it's not over yet. I think the way of doing this is very good, because what we're doing is, it's rather intense for this couple of days, and then tonight we get a good night's sleep, have a nice rest, sleep, good sleep. But then when we get up in the morning, by the way, it will be earlier than the other mornings. We usually get up at 6 something. Tomorrow morning it will be, I think, 5:15. We wake up. So please be aware of the schedule. Tomorrow morning it's a little different. You get to go to sleep, but you got to get up earlier. Because of the ending of the retreat. So be aware of that. And we will have a chance to sit. I would like to have one more one-on-one with everyone tomorrow morning. Depending on how long that takes, then give at least a brief final talk more about how to take this into the world, how to finish this and move on without missing a beat, so to speak. And then hopefully at the end maybe have a chance once more for a go-around, a moment for everyone to say a word, and then pack, and I'll have to leave, I forget, around 8 in the morning or something. I have a plane from Schiphol. I forget, 10:15. So I'll have to leave pretty quickly in the morning, but I guess everyone else can take their time leaving. I would like to say goodbye to everyone tomorrow morning. So again, please be aware of the slight change in the schedule tomorrow morning. It's from 5:15, so please be here on time. Let me return now to that strange story from the Lotus Sutra. I've already explained that this Buddha of penetrating wisdom was sitting on the lotus throne for endless kalpas, eons, performing all of the right practices, perfectly at rest in body and in mind. And yet, Buddhahood was not revealed to him. He did not realize the truth. This actually became a kind of a great doubt for at least one Zen monk hundreds of years later after the sutra was written in China. A Chinese Zen monk heard that story and, perhaps like you, just couldn't get it. I don't understand. Of course, he wasn't just asking about this obviously legendary Buddha of the infinite past, who trained for zillions and zillions of years. He's asking about his own practice. So, to take this story one more step. In China, there's a monk who reading that story in the Lotus Sutra or hearing it becomes his question. So he asks his master, his Zen master. It says that the Buddha of all-knowing wisdom sat in, they say, Zazen. Of course, in the Buddha Sutra, it doesn't call it Zazen. It calls it meditation. The Chinese monk. He sat Zazen on a Bodhi seat. Again, you'll see the language has changed a little bit by the time it gets to China, but it's not important. Sat Zazen on a Bodhi seat for 10 kalpas. Only 10 kalpas in this version, but still. 1 kalpa is already billions of years. I wouldn't worry. I think it's a technical difference. Somebody forgot a couple of zeros at the end. So. Anyway, a hell of a lot longer than we've been sitting. So again, the monk, this Chinese Zen monk, is asking his master in the context of that Lotus Sutra story. The Buddha of all-knowing wisdom sat Zazen on a Bodhi seat for 10 kalpas. Buddha Dharma, the Buddha's truth, was not manifested, nor did he attain Buddhahood. Why? Why? The monk asked. Not a bad question, huh? You may think, I can never get it all right. May seem like not a very encouraging story to tell all of you, right? I can't even get the first base, and you're talking about a guy who hits grand slams with, you know, with perfect ease, and he doesn't even win the game, you know? Jeez, thanks, a lot of hope for me. But of course, that's not the point of the story. First of all, the monk is asking, in a sense, certainly for the self, a very legitimate question, perhaps an inevitable question for the self, right? He has been practicing for some time. He's a Zen monk. And yet, perhaps like us, he comes upon this story and it's like, what? Oh, Christ, there's no chance for me, right? So his question is not so difficult to see into. Once again, he asked, the Buddha of all-knowing wisdom sat Zazen on a Bodhi seat for 10 kalpas. Buddha Dharma was not manifested, nor did he attain Buddhahood. This much is what it says in the Lotus Sutra. And then the monk says, why? Why? I want to know why. Tell me why. How can this be? What do you think the master says in response? What does a Buddha say in response to that monk's not just question, but his situation, his prison that he has found himself in. Huh? How do you respond to this? Why? Why? Do you know how this particular master at this time, at this place, for this monk responded? Oh, I wanted to tell you, but I forgot to write it down. Sorry. I knew it was in here. The master simply responds, once again, the monk is saying, why? Why didn't he get it? The master responds, that's a marvelous question. That's a marvelous question. In Chinese, this is called chasing after the robber, the thief, chasing after the robber on his own horse. Some masters might strike the monk. Fool, don't ask such stupid question. But this master, for this monk at this time, at this place, responded, what a marvelous question. A good question. He doesn't deny where the monk is at all. Rather than denying it, he almost embraces him to help him see through. A good question. Marvelous question. Do you see where the master is coming from when he says that? Yes, yours, you might, yours is a good question. Unfortunately, the monk didn't get it. So, according to the record, he persists. He's a stubborn monk. Maybe he put in a lot of time and effort, and he feels it's all wasted now. So, according to the record, the monk persisted. He again said, he sat Zazen on a Bodhi seat. Right? We don't even have these in China anymore. Fine. He sat Zazen on a Bodhi seat. Why did he not attain Buddhahood? The monk persisted. He didn't give in to the master. He, this Buddha of penetrating wisdom, sat Zazen on a Bodhi seat. Bodhi seat, awakening seat. That's what Bodhisattva, awakening being, means. A Bodhi seat. He was the man. He was sitting right on it. Why did he not attain Buddha? What does the master respond? How do we respond to that? How do we lend a helping hand to that monk? The master said, because he didn't attain Buddha. Because he didn't attain Buddha. It doesn't record if the monk was enlightened with that response, but it was recognized as such a precious exchange between a monk at a certain place in his practice and the master that it has continued down to this day over 1,000 years. Is this, to some extent, your own question? If not, what is? To some extent, perhaps, this is your question. Have I not put in a great deal of time, a great deal of effort, a lot of pain, a lot of sleepiness? Where am I now? A very good question. Where are you now? Once again, as I said yesterday, get the question clear and you're close to the answer, to the solution. That monk, in being able to come up, perhaps it was inevitable for him, he couldn't help hearing or reading that story in the Lotus Sutra. Wait a minute! Why? He couldn't help but ask that question. So in that sense, the question that you are, your own most intimate question, can be very valuable. If you get the question clear, precise, like an instrument, get get the question clear, and you're close to the answer, to the solution. Or again, as I put it, and you're right on top of it. You can't miss it then. You can't miss it. The question will drive you there. The question, or even just if you don't have a question in that sense, the sitting itself becomes you, as I said yesterday. You become the question itself, or the sitting itself. And with that, self-delusion ends. It cannot be maintained. Again, as I said earlier today, it is unself-sustainable. It is only the grasping and the endless action of the deluded self that keeps some semblance alive. Once that falls away, because it cannot be maintained, it cannot last forever. But to once see through it for ourselves, to let it come to its natural end, to its natural conclusion. Huh? Again, as the master said to the monk, why? Good question. What a marvelous question. You might rephrase it. Take that question all the way, and you're there. But again, not wanting to spoil the monk when he asked the question again, why did he not attain Buddhahood? The master, very kindly, but apparently, may not look kind, but it was. Why didn't he attain Buddhahood? Because he didn't attain Buddhahood. He doesn't give the monk, in the ordinary sense, anything, does he? He doesn't give him a crumb. Nothing. Why didn't he attain Buddha? Because he didn't attain Buddha. See through that. Don't come up with explanations and descriptions. Simply see through the question itself. If you can really see through that, it's obvious, isn't it? His attaining Buddhahood or not doesn't make the least bit of difference.
What's the meaning of the word attain?
Attain, very good. To attain, achieve. It's interesting because in the four vows we recite in the common translation, I believe that word is actually used, right? In the middle version, I vow to attain it, the Buddha way, which is precisely what is going on in this Lotus Story Sutra. To attain it.
So attaining is good. In this story, isn't that good?
Certainly for the self, attaining is all it has. But what does it really mean to attain Buddhahood? Can the self attain no self? Do you see? What is happening is the self is using its dynamics, the way it works in the world. I want this. Now, it becomes a monk or a nun, and it's going to go on the Buddha way, the Buddha path. And so it brings its little bags of tools and tricks, right? And it tries to attain that, like rising up to become the head of your company, right? And this kind of statement, it's not the uncommon in Zen. It's quite common, actually. This kind of statement is challenging that kind of illusion, you see? Again, it's not saying, so don't do anything. We can all just go home. Let's go have a beer. He's not saying that. Right effort. We cannot bring the delusions of ourself on the Buddha way. It will not work. You see? So that is what is being challenged here. That is what the monk could not see. Okay. So attain, in a sense, that's what it's all about, to attain it. But it's not something that the self can achieve or attain. As a matter of fact, it's the coming to the end of that very cycle.
But I wonder if the world itself, the work, the thing itself, got the power. I don't think.
I don't know what you mean, the power?
The thing, bereiken.
Bereiken.
A thing in the world itself, there is, in my vision, the false way.
That's very true. Ultimately, that's true. It cannot be attained. Mm-hmm. That itself isn't. That is maybe the final illusion for the self. Mm-hmm. Right. So again, the background of the story in the Lotus Sutra is, it's making clear that this Buddha is doing all of the things that it needs to do to attain its goal, its cherished goal. All of the practices, the paramitas, charity and everything, practice of meditation, all, it's all there. And that's precisely what this koan is asking us about. But he doesn't attain it. Why? Do you see? And that became the sticking point for that monk. So he raised this question. But that's precisely the point. Attain. Mm-hmm. How do I attain that? You cannot. That's where the real practice begins there. When you realize that you cannot do anything in the ordinary sense. That's why we sit like this. Yes, well, completely open, yes. But without our bag of tricks. Otherwise, I think you see, you're endlessly chasing your own tail. Even if you do attain something, well, there's always something else to attain, or something else to attain, or something else. And it just becomes a vicious cycle. Or even worse, the self does have some kind of experience and mistakes that for attainment of Buddhahood, right? And then, as I put it, you become the biggest no-self around. It's a very ugly thing to see. I'm going to tell you how to realize this. It's that kind of attitude that comes out. So, in the beginning, perhaps, the self cannot avoid chasing after its own tail, because that's all it knows how to do, to attain, to get better. Show me a technique. I want to do it quickly, right? Give me a koan, something, right? So that I can attain this. Well, one way in Zen is simply to take that all away. And in a sense, that's what the master is doing. And just leaving the monk with his question, right? Good question. That'll do, we might say. That'll do. Not the attainment, that will do, you see? The question itself. There are many Zen expressions that touch on this. For example, an ordinary person, you and me, huh? An ordinary person realizes it and becomes a sage, a saint. a saint sees through it and becomes an ordinary person. That is what Zen emphasizes. Of course, we have to, in a sense, if we don't say attain, realize, is there a better word for it? Drop the illusion. No self realizing itself. However we describe it, the fact is, we, as an ordinary person that we are, we don't become some superhuman Buddha. By really being who we are, we realize what it is to be a sage. And in really realizing what it is to be a sage, really penetrating to the bottom of that, is to be an ordinary person. In other words, to have no odor of enlightenment. Enlightenment cannot have an odor, and yet some people have the stench of some kind of realization. You see how immature that is, how it cannot be the fruition. It's more this something becoming spoiled. You can smell it. Layman Pang has a wonderful expression. Layman Pang was a Chinese layperson. He studied and deeply realized, but did not become a monk. Layman Pang says, one of his famous poems, how marvelous collecting firewood and hauling water. Because when he realized, when he fell through, he was a layman, and he did it in such a way that it became what he was doing. So again, how marvelous, sitting on the Buddha throne, if you want, huh? How marvelous. But for him, collecting water from the well, carrying fire. That's fine. You see, that's the sage becoming an ordinary person. This is a very important part in our practice. You might say, doing what must be done at that time, at that place. Doing what must be done is complete freedom. But the ego self cannot attain that. It wants to, right? But the ego self cannot attain that. It instinctively wants to get away from responsibility, from limitations. I want to be free. I want to be able to do what I want. You might say, doing what must be done. That moment, perhaps carrying firewood, collecting water from the well, whatever it may be in your life. You can realize that is utter freedom, complete freedom, without self. That's the trick. Ego self cannot attain that. That's right. It is the ego self trying to attain it that creates the barrier. Clearly seeing and doing what must be done at any time and any place in your life. Everyone's life is different. Clearly seeing and doing what must be done is the freedom you seek. Complete freedom. Carrying the firewood. Answering the telephone. When self is gone, anything will do. As long as self remains, nothing will do. Thus, we do what we do in our practice. Once again, I ask you, what about this Buddha of all knowing, all penetrating wisdom? What about that? What about you in your practice? Please, we have precious hours left. Let us make good use of it. I believe we now have a tea break.
Yes.
Thank you for listening so intently and for your questions.